If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On the throne from 1760 until 1820, George III was Britain's third longest reigning monarch. Among other things, his reign witnessed the Industrial Revolution, the abolition of the slave trade, and the loss of the American colonies. The historian Andrew Roberts has just published a major new biography of the king, and has also written about him for the November issue of BBC History Magazine. In today's interview with the magazine's editor, Rob Attar, Andrew explores George's eventful life and seeks to explode some of the myths that have grown up around him.
Andrew, when I first spoke to you about this book, you mentioned three key pillars to your reappraisal of George III: that he didn't have porphyria, that he wasn't a tyrant in America, and that he wasn't an unconstitutional monarch in Britain either. So if we could begin perhaps with the accusation of tyranny in America. How far do you think he was personally responsible for the loss of the American colonies?
I don't think he was personally responsible to any great degree at all. It was a politico-military series of decisions. He wasn't the primary mover in the political ones. That was obviously the government, Lord North's government. And he certainly wasn't involved in the grand strategy that was set by the government and followed through by the generals. And the ministers lost that war, not George III.
It's fair to say that for many of the patriots, he was a hate figure and they did view him as a tyrant. Why do you think that was?
Well, no, I don't believe they did at the beginning of the war at all. They called it the Parliamentary Army rather than the Royal Army. They didn't start pulling down bits of royal insignia off buildings until after the Declaration of Independence in July 1776, which, of course, was a good year and a bit after the war had started, which, if you have April 1775 as the time when Lexington and Concord saw the first shots fired, is well over a year, where they're fighting against somebody who they don't really consider to be a tyrant. It's very much this extraordinary document, sublime English, beautiful phraseology, almost Shakespearean language of the Declaration of Independence that created this this very necessary propaganda myth, as far as the Americans were concerned, of a tyrant king.
And in the Declaration of Independence, how was this view of him being a tyrant king justified?
Well, it was justified very largely on ex post facto rationalisation, because it blamed him for things that had already happened after they had started the war in many instances. In about half of the 28 clauses refer to things that were after the Lexington and Concord shots had already been fired. You see, in the 18th century, if you're looking at Samuel Johnson, his Dictionary of the English Language, for example, a tyrant is either an absolute monarch governing imperiously or a cruel, despotic and severe master. And George III was neither of those. You know, he was not an absolute monarch. He had his parliaments and his governments that he had to act through. He never overruled an act of parliament, for example. He certainly didn't govern imperiously, not least because he didn't actually govern himself at all. And far from being a cruel, despotic and severe master, in fact, he was an immensely good-natured man. He was as far from a despotic person as possible, certainly not in the slightest bit severe. So, you know, under no circumstances, except for those of the exigencies of the necessity of wartime, would anyone call George III a tyrant. But today, when one looks at the American, you know, cybersphere and so on, and then newspapers and endless blogs and websites, he's routinely called a tyrant and a despot and a dictator and all of these various quite 20th century concepts, which completely misunderstand what he genuinely was. You know, we see the word dictator and we think of Mussolini and Stalin and Hitler and so on, people like that. You know, George III could not be more different from those kind of people.
And a point that you make in the feature you've written for the magazine is that British rule in America wasn't necessarily that oppressive anyway. Is that fair to say?
Oh, totally, yes. I mean, Richard Brookhiser refers to it as the freest society in the world. It did not have, you know, armed forces that were marching down the streets. It did not have newspapers that were being closed down and editors arrested and so on. It certainly wasn't anything like the genuine tyrannies of some of the European states and their what they were doing in their empires. You know, you had the Spanish executing any number of people in Louisiana when that revolt started. You had the Russians killing tens of thousands of people in the Pugachev uprising. Gosh, all over the world, people were acting in the most abominable ways, genuine tyrannies. And so far removed from that are the 13 colonies who were allowed pretty much to get on and do whatever they wanted.
So why then do you think they were so keen to push for independence?
Well, the time had come for independence. They were a mature state, essentially. They had a raring economy that was going twice the size of Britain's. They had 2.5 million people there, which was a significant number, population. Obviously, 600,000 of them were enslaved people, and so they weren't taking part in the advances of the rest of society, but the rest of them, you know, were creating a viable state with Philadelphia had many more bookshops than the whole of the rest of the United Kingdom combined, apart from London. You know, this was a proper grown up state ready for statehood, and this is the interesting thing, you see, because they revolted for independence. For sovereignty, for self-government, all those good things. And I think that makes them pretty exceptional that they were revolting for that, even though they were not being tyrannized. History is absolutely packed with any number of examples of people who grab their independence against the tyrannizing force. You look at the Dutch against the Austrians in Holland. You look at the Greeks against the Turks, the Israelites against the Egyptians. You know, all the way through history, peoples have grasped their independence against the despotic master. What makes America exceptional is that, in fact, they grasped their independence against a master who was so light touch that some of the states only had about 17 or 20 royal officials working there.
So what was George's response to the loss of the American colonies? Did he still feel that keenly?
Yes, he felt it extremely keenly for the whole of the rest of his life. You know, it was a complete foreign policy catastrophe. It set back his country. It didn't actually set back the size of his empire. His empire, when he died, was much larger than it was when he had started, and was by that stage the largest empire in the world. But nonetheless, of course, as far as the sort of imperial GDP, for example, is concerned, the loss of America was extremely serious. It was, you know, his great defeat.
And what kind of relationship did George have with the first couple of American presidents, George Washington and then John Adams?
Well, with George Washington, who he never met, of course, nonetheless, he called him in March 1797 the greatest character of the age. Which I think, considering what George Washington had been responsible for, with that sublime leadership of Washington's, keeping that army together in Valley Forge over that winter, was truly extraordinary. And you would have understood if George III didn't have a good word to say about him, but he did, not just on that, but on other occasions. And then with John Adams, who also, of course, was right in the forefront of the revolution. When John Adams came to be the ambassador of Britain, to Britain, the American ambassador, George III, at the formal audience with him, said, "I'll be very frank with you. I was the last to consent to the separation, but the separation having been made and having become inevitable, I've always said, and I say now, that I would be the first to meet the friendship of the United States as an independent power." That's a difficult thing that would have stuck in the craw of an awful lot of monarchs, but which George was willing to say. And actually, John Adams had a lot of very positive and nice things to say about George III, you know, once the revolution was won.
So actually coming on to George's, what's been described as his madness, I suppose that might be how people best know it. I don't know if that's an appropriate term or not. So one of the arguments you make in the book is that he didn't have porphyria. So what actually is porphyria, and when did that diagnosis come about?
Porphyria is a blood disease that gives you, it's a horrible, horrible disease. The more I learned about it, the more ghastly it sounded. It's a disease that puts you into a fever that looks almost exactly like madness, but it isn't madness. It's a you know, physical disease. And this idea cropped up in the 1960s with a couple called Ida McAlpine and her son, Dr. Hunter. And they put forward this idea. And unfortunately, the way they did it was to give a series of very ill-chosen, or at least as far as they might have been concerned, very cleverly chosen, symptoms to doctors who wound up saying, yes, this was the disease. But actually, when one looks into what they sent the doctors, they were either not George's symptoms at all, or they were just a tiny percentage of the things that happened to George. They really not only misinterpreted it amongst themselves, but also gave the doctors the wrong symptoms. And so by the end of the 1960s, everybody believed that he had this porphyria. But it was only much later, only in the last 10 years or so, that historians and doctors have looked again at the actual symptoms and recognized this was not porphyria at all. It's a completely different thing. It's a disease of the mind. It's essentially a bipolar disorder is what he had. And now, luckily, now that we live in an era which does not stigmatize mental illness, we can recognize that all of the horrific things that were said about George III, that his madness was sort of held against him morally, effectively, for you know, two centuries. And I think it's very good that we can now, you know, get beyond that.
And how far did his mental illnesses affect his reign? How incapacitated was he by then?
Well, he was pretty much totally incapacitated whilst he had it badly. But the extraordinary thing is that he was a sort of shocked spectator at his own mental collapse, because he had these long episodes of perfect sanity during them. So he could see what was going on almost as an outsider, which is a sort of added tragedy to the whole story. I mean, the pathos of it is incredibly powerful. This poor man with his manic depression, it was sometimes so well that they actually let him sign acts of parliament and meet the prime minister and approve cabinet decisions and he signed warrants for the national debt and things like that whilst he was actually on the same day that they were putting him in a straitjacket. The chapters that deal with this in my book are I think rather moving, because there's this good man who has this terrible thing happen, which of course destroys his family life as well as everything else, and yet he can actually see it going on almost, as I say, as a spectator. There's no indication that any of the decisions that he ever took, political ones, were taken under the influence of his bipolar disease. He had a in 1765 he had a short what's called a prodrome attack of it at the time of the Stamp Act, but there's no indication that he'd have done anything differently had he not been suffering from it at the time as well.
And so the third major revisionist argument of your book is that he wasn't an unconstitutional monarch. So who has put forward the argument that he was, and why do you feel they're wrong?
Oh, the Whig historians for 100 years put forward this idea that he was a sort of, authoritarian and a despot in British domestic policy. And that's simply because he was the first monarch after 100 years after the Glorious Revolution to not go along with the sort of Whig oligarchy that had ruled Britain for the full century after that revolution. He thought that the best people in politics, regardless of their political opinions, including Tories, should be allowed into government. And he put that into place. And so the Whigs, in a sort of scream of rage ever since, have denounced him for being a despot. There was no authoritarian side to him. He only actually sacked one sitting ministry that the House of Commons supported. And that was because the Whigs, Edmund Burke and Charles James Fox and others, were trying to nationalise the East India Company and grab all of the extraordinary wealth of India for a 7-man commission that was going to be appointed entirely by the Whigs. And they mentioned, they had the names of the commissioners, and they were all, brothers-in-law and cousins and members of the Brooks's Club and various other major Whig oligarchs themselves. So, when he sacked that ministry and brought in William Pitt the Younger, and it was all put to a general election, William Pitt the Younger won by a landslide.
How much power did a monarch have in 18th century Britain? I mean, we know now our monarchs have very little power. 250 years earlier, they had a huge amount of power. Where does George III sit in that scale?
Well, it's the old story of de facto power versus de jure power. They had a lot of power in theory to make treaties, dismiss governments, make war, of course, and peace. And so, in theory, at least, he had enormous amounts of power. He could veto bills of the House of Commons and the House of Lords, but he didn't use these powers any more than his grandfather George II had, and he used them an awful lot less than some of the earlier monarchs. He never vetoed a bill, for example. That was Queen Anne who was the last person to do that. So In fact, he fits very easily, I think, in the trajectory between the Glorious Revolution and Queen Victoria, and the sort of system that we have now, where obviously the Queen reigns but she doesn't rule. George reigned; he didn't rule either, but he certainly had the right to and exercised the right to have prime ministers that he got on with and liked. And very often that was the problem. You know, the ones he liked the most, people like the Earl of Bute and Lord North, turned out to be the really bad ones. And the ones that he had relative little personal connection with, like William Pitt the Younger, turned out to be the best ones.
How did George III himself see the role of a king on the domestic front?
Well, he very much saw himself as a unifying force in society. He saw himself as being the fount of honour to make sure that the honour system worked. He saw himself as a sort of a royal role model for morality. He was the only one of the Hanoverians who loved his wife and was faithful to her. And he believed in that and made something of it. In fact, one of his character flaws, really, which I do bring out in this book, is a tremendous sense of self-righteousness. You know, he really did look down on those politicians who had mistresses and so on, of which this was the 18th century aristocracy. You know, they pretty much all did, frankly. But he took his personal friends from people who loved their wives and went to church and were led decent, upstanding lives. And so you do get a sense of self-righteousness from him. But no, he had a very strong sense of what he needed to do as king. And of course, in wartime, that too was accentuated. He organized or helped organize the force against the invasion that was expected in 1778 and then again in 1802 to 1805. And, you know, and he'd visit the camps and show himself amongst the populace in these enormous meetings that they had in London of the yeomanry, you know, 50,000 men drawn up on Hyde Park and so on, you know. So he took a very active role in all of that as well, went down to Portsmouth to make sure that the fleet was ready to sail and so on. So, yes, of course, he also considered himself and was the supreme governor of the Church of England, and he was a true believer in the Church of England. His Anglicanism is one of the most powerful aspects of him and his Christianity. And he has this very much this sense that he is the head of the church in England, and he worries about the quality of the bishops and, you know, whether or not they're intellectual enough and so on, which was also a pretty sort of un-18th century stance to take, frankly.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I mean, he was constantly in debt. He was sexually incontinent. He betrayed everybody he ever came across, especially politically. He was a thoroughly nasty piece of work.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So you alluded earlier to the events of 1805, which is the threatened invasion from Napoleon. I mean, how big an event in general was the French Revolution for George III's reign, and particularly the execution of his fellow monarch in France?
It was a massive, key moment, because the idea that European monarch could actually be guillotined was utterly shocking, obviously to him and the royal family, because they're the people who would likely to be guillotined if the same thing happened in London. But also just on a much wider scale, you know, that it struck at the whole concept of monarchy and kingliness, as it were. It also brought the nation together in an amazing way. The regicides in France of the king and queen really made George the most popular he'd ever been and was to be in his reign. He was very much opposed to peace with France until the regicidal government was overthrown. And of course, that didn't happen for a very long time because Napoleon was such a good soldier. But and by the time it did happen in 1815, he was confined at Windsor Castle. So he never knew that the Battle of Waterloo had taken place, for example, which is another sort of aspect of the pathos of the last days of the king. One of the great things was, though, that because of that East India crisis that I mentioned earlier, Pitt the Younger had been in power for 5 years before the French Revolution broke out, and so he was able to be a one of our greatest prime ministers, of course. But he was there at exactly the right time, at exactly the right place. Whereas had Charles James Fox become prime minister, as he threatened to do, you would have had in charge in Britain somebody who actually welcomed the French Revolution and said, you know, very much agreed with Wordsworth and bliss was it in that dawn to be alive kind of stance. You know, he said it was how much the best thing that has ever happened in history was Charles James Fox's response to the French Revolution. So, you know, it was a real act of luck that George III had this very strong anti-French prime minister in Pitt the Younger.
So when we were talking about the American colonies before, you did make the point that actually the British Empire expanded in many other areas during George III's reign. How personally invested was he in the growth of the empire?
Very little, actually. It was one of the surprises of the book, how the huge expanse of the empire in Australia, of course, which Captain Cook was one of the people that George III actually gave money to that expedition in order to find out. He was more interested in flora and fauna, actually, than the territory. But nonetheless, he was involved in that. He never took much interest in India, apart from the moment where he didn't want the riches of India to fall into the hands of the Whigs. Although he followed the struggles going on in the Maratha Wars and with the Clive of India and so on, he wasn't a what one would call an imperialist, really. He saw it all happen, but didn't get tremendously excited about it.
And this period also, of course, saw extensive slave trading by the British Empire and then later the abolition of the slave trade. Do we know what George's views were on the slave trade and the abolition campaign?
We do, luckily, because he wrote them down when he was Prince of Wales. And he used to write long essays on history and many other things, geography and science and so on. And he wrote on Montesquieu's essays, the essays on laws that Montesquieu set out his own very strong pro-abolitionist, anti-slaving views. And George, as Prince of Wales, unfortunately, he didn't date the essay, but we can date it from whereabouts it is in the papers to the late 1750s, so just before he becomes king in 1760, agreeing with Montesquieu and saying that all the arguments put forward in favour of slavery are ludicrous, I think is one of the words he uses. Ridiculous is another one. I take out that page and use it as an illustration as well as quote from it quite extensively, because it shows that he didn't go along with these views that some, even Christians, even, you know, proper fully paid up card-carrying Christians had, that that slavery was morally acceptable. He knew it wasn't. He didn't invest in the in the great successful companies that people were making so much money from, the slaving companies. He didn't own any slaves himself. He signed the legislation, of course, as I think you were just referring to, in 1807, which abolished the slave trade. I never found anything to suggest that he was against abolition, but it is, of course, a blot on his escutcheon that he didn't support abolition. You know, we now know today that it's what an awful thing slavery was, what a hateful and vicious and evil thing it was, and that somebody, therefore, who considered themselves to be a Christian, like George III did, ought to have been more active in the abolition movement. But I think partly because he was a constitutional monarch, as I say, you know, he didn't involve himself in politics to that degree. And also because there was a geopolitical aspect to it, whereby the just the sheer revenues that Britain was getting from the West Indian islands, which far, far larger than the revenues we ever got from the Americas, from the American colonies, about a third of British revenue came from sugar and tobacco and everything else that was being made in the West Indies. And I'm afraid, although I have no actual evidence, because he didn't write about this or speak about it, I suspect that he took a very cold-hearted stance and realised that it would bankrupt Britain if we didn't have the slave trade. Until, as I say, 1807, by which time the parliamentary forces were such that they were ready to compensate the slave owners and try and change the whole economic basis of slavery. But it is definitely a blot on him for not having been more abolitionist.
And I realise this is a counterfactual, but had he been a more vocal supporter of abolition, might that have taken place earlier?
Well, he'd have had to have sort of done the same thing as he sometimes had to do when he was moving, he was helping governments, which is basically to tell his friends in the House of Commons and the House of Lords to vote for a particular bill. So he'd have had to have been unconstitutional, in fact, if he wanted to try to abolish slavery. And there are some moments, you know, a classic one being the Stamp Act, which the American colonists hated so much. He did put his sort of influence on the line to get that repealed, and came to regret it later, actually. But yes, he could have done that over the slave trade had he considered it to have been as important a aspect of civilization as we recognize it to be today.
Now, in your conclusion, you quote the author John Brooke as saying that George had good claims to be considered the most cultured monarch ever to sit on the throne of Great Britain. First of all, I guess you believe that's true to have quoted it, but how did that culture manifest itself?
Oh, yes. Well, here's another, you know, the Americans, still a lot of them go along with this concept that was put forward by Thomas Paine in his pamphlet, his political pamphlet of 1776, Common Sense, which called him the royal brute of Britain, you know, and made out that he was a thick and B, you know, brutish. This could not be further from the truth. You know, one only has to read these essays that I mentioned earlier, but his letters to realise that he was an intelligent man. But he was also a tremendously cultured one. You've worked in the British Library. You know that those 80,000 books that form the basis of the centre stacks in the British Library entirely come from George the Third's library. And it's a library that he really took a lot of trouble over. He was close to his librarian. He spent an enormous amount of money on the binding and rebinding of books. He allowed people to, like Dr. Johnson, to use the library, to come in. You know, any sort of gentleman off the street could use his library at Buckingham House, later Buckingham Palace. So there's that. But also planet Uranus was originally named after him, George's star, it was called, because he had given Herschel huge amounts of money to create the world's largest telescope. He was the figure in the creation of the Royal Academy. That was him. He actually wrote out the foundation document of the Royal Academy in his own hand. He had a tremendous artistic taste. The paintings that he bought and so on. I'm not saying he was as artistic as George IV or Charles I, but I am saying that he was a tremendously cultured man in a way that Tom Paine and other Whig writers just simply haven't even engaged with.
And did he take much interest in the great scientific technological changes that were powering the Industrial Revolution?
Huge. Interestingly, not the Industrial Revolution. He was hugely interested in scientific changes. He was the man who made sure that the discoverer of longitude was paid properly. He was involved in. He had the largest collection of scientific instruments, and it was a collection. He wasn't using them himself; he was collecting them. But the largest collection of scientific instruments in the world at the time. It's still the main piece of the Science Museum here in London. When it came to what was going on with the spinning jenny and the Arkwrights, he was mad by the end of that period, by the beginning of that period, really. But he was not involved terribly much. He bought, or at least Queen Charlotte, his wife, was given Josiah Wedgwood's pottery, and they very much approved of Wedgwood and his advances there. There's a very good book, actually, that Tristram Hunt has just written about Josiah Wedgwood, in which Queen Charlotte's patronage of that is highlighted. But he wasn't one for going down. He never went down a mine, for example. He never went north of. I mean, the Industrial Revolution, a larger part of it took place in the Midlands of England, and he never went north of Worcester. So, and it's extraordinary. It's a very interesting aspect to him. You know, not only did he not go to America or India or Hanover, he was Elector of Hanover all his reign, of course. But he never actually went north of the line. He never went to Cambridge. He never went to anywhere north of Worcester or west of Weymouth. Never went to Wales. Never went to Ireland. You know, he was king of these places.
Why do you think it was that he didn't have this desire to travel and see the lands he reigned over?
It's fascinating, isn't it? It's George IV, of course, goes up to Scotland and makes a big thing. He's the first person, king, since one of the medieval monarchs, I can't remember which one, never to have visited the continent. I think that although he had a tremendous curiosity when it came to things of the mind, as far as actual sort of seeing things, views and foreign countries and everything, and also the pleasure of travel, he just was uninterested in it. I mean, travel was much more difficult in those days, obviously, but nonetheless, Prince Charles has a fascinating fascinating what if in the foreword to that Brooke book that you mentioned, where he posits, you know, what if George had actually physically gone to the 13 colonies and had seen the issues for themselves, the things that they wanted to do, had charmed the top people there, as he was a charming man, and actually had physically gone there. Things might have been different.
Do we know what kind of views or concerns George had for the ordinary person in Britain? How much did he take an interest in their lot?
He was a very good king in that regard. He was very good at meeting people personally. Very often, people actually who didn't know that he was king. He used to do sort of walkabouts and wander around the countryside without his guards and entourage, and would sort of chat to peasants in the street and so on. And there are lots of examples of this. And at no point do they realise that he's king until it's pointed out to them later. So he was good on that kind of interaction. He sort of invented the Royal Walkabout, actually, on the North Terrace in Windsor. It's interesting how many of the modern aspects of monarchy he is. I think it's much more him than Queen Victoria, in fact, who edges the monarchy into its modern state. But he has a sort of natural affinity with ordinary people. That said, again, he was not doing things like passing Factories Act and getting involved in social welfare and reforms and so on. You know, as I say, he was a constitutional monarch. He expected the politicians to do all that.
One other quality of George's that comes out in your book is his own personal courage. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
I think George considered personal courage to be an important attribute of a monarch, and he certainly had it in spades himself. There were any number of assassination attempts against him. There are different ways of counting them, of course, the extent to how serious they were. But certainly five or six that could very easily have led to his death. And on each occasion, he was tremendously brave. He was very brave during the Gordon riots. In fact, one of the people watching him at that time in 1780 said, "I am persuaded that the king does not know what fear is." Which is something. During the invasion threats of 1778, 79, and also the later one from Napoleon, he was right at the forefront of the measures to counter it. He had his personal accoutrements made ready so that he could leave Windsor Castle in half an hour and go and join the army to fight if the French actually landed. And then, of course, again and again, when his mental collapse, he showed tremendous courage there, where he faced what he knew was going to be appalling things. Some of the things that the doctors did in terms of cupping and bleeding him and putting leeches on his eyes and so on was so repulsive and painful and for our ears today, disgusting. And yet he faced all of those with a enormous courage as well. So I think, yes, there are aspects of George III that aren't attractive. His self-righteousness and sort of general, you know, piousness can be irritating. It must have been immensely irritating to his prime ministers of the day. But overall, here is a man with a lovely sense of humour, good nature, and personal courage, and deep personal morality as well. I really do think he's a tremendously misunderstood. If you look at the way he's lampooned in various things today, you just don't recognise, as an historian, you just don't recognise the person at all.
You've painted many, or described many, admirable qualities of George III, and it seems that very few of those were embodied by his son and successor, George IV. Why do you think he was such a contrast to his father?
Well, all of those Hanoverians were, weren't they, to a degree? Actually, George III himself loved his father, the Prince of Wales, Prince Frederick, and Frederick loved him. But they were pretty much the exception. Otherwise, every generation of Hanoverians pretty much hates their parents, and it goes on and on. George IV was a profoundly unpleasant piece of work, frankly. He again, as I mentioned earlier, had a beautiful aesthetic taste, certainly. But he had compulsive buying disorder, CBD, which is now recognised to be a disease, but at the time wasn't, obviously. And he could spend something like a quarter of the British GDP, the same amount that we were spending on the Royal Navy, was being spent by George IV on furniture and carriages and I don't know, chinoiserie. He would send people off to China to buy antiques and so on like that. I mean, he was constantly in debt. He was sexually incontinent. He betrayed everybody he ever came across, especially politically. He was a thoroughly nasty piece of work. And George III was as kind to him and as loving as he could be. But frankly, sometimes, especially when George IV would do things like publish his private correspondence with his father, it just became completely intolerable.
What do you see as George III's legacy, both on the royal family and also the lands he reigned over?
Well, I think his legacy over in the royal family actually was a very strong one. You know, if one looks at the reign of the present queen and sees her sense of duty, her very much taking seriously her role as the supreme governor of the Church of England, somebody who has a spotless private life, somebody who is entirely sort of admirable personally. You get these from George. You also get other ideas. You know, he was the first one for a long time since Charles I to be buried at Windsor. Since then, all of them have been buried at Windsor, pretty much all of them. He invented the ride at Royal Ascot. He invented a special Windsor uniform that the royal family still wear at Windsor Castle when they're dining at Windsor Castle today. You know, there are lots of aspects of modern royal life that one gets from George III, much more, I think, than even than Queen Victoria, his granddaughter, who I think must have herself had several traits that came from George III. As far as the overall legacy is concerned, of course, ultimately it was probably not that bad to have lost America in the late 1780s, because, you know, it was going to happen one day. It was going to become the most powerful and rich country in the world. And if we'd still been constitutionally attached to it, you could have been on the receiving end of a sort of reverse takeover, in fact. So I think the very happy history of the English-speaking peoples is probably better now that we're separate states.
That was Andrew Roberts. Andrew's book, George III, The Life and Reign of Britain's Most Misunderstood Monarch, is out now, published by Alan Lane. And as I mentioned at the start, Andrew's also written a piece on the King for the November issue of BBC History magazine. That's on sale now, and also includes pieces on tanks of the Second World War, medieval duels, and the rivalry between Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Join us again tomorrow when we'll be speaking to Professor Tyler Stovall about his book, White Freedom, The Racial History of an Idea.